Welcome to the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate Podcast, brought to you by Limitless Estates, where Kyle and Lalita talk to top experts and seasoned passive investors in the business to help provide clarity and key insights to keep you safe on your journey to financial freedom. Our goal is to help you get educated on how to create passive income for you and your family by using real estate as your vehicle. Now here are your hosts, Kyle and Lalita.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate Podcast. I'm your co-host Lalita, also joined by Kyle. Today we have Paul Moore on the show with us. Paul, excited to have you here. How are you?
I'm great. It's an honor to be here.
Fantastic. Well, let's get started. Paul began his career at Ford Motor Company after earning an MBA from Ohio State. Paul later entered the real estate sector where he flipped over 50 homes and 25 high-end waterfront lots, appeared on HGTV's House Hunters, developed a subdivision, started two successful online real estate marketing firms, and the list goes on and on. In addition, Paul is an author and has his own podcast. Well, this can go on for a while, and we've got so much to cover. So, Paul, why don't you take it from here and tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself and what you currently do?
Well, I'm really, like I said, I'm really glad to be on your show. You two have just been rocking it in multifamily, and I'm just so happy to hear about where you're going and what you're doing. You've done what a lot of people haven't been able to do in multifamily right now. You know, I wrote a book on multifamily investing called The Perfect Investment a number of years ago. I think you read it, Kyle. And, you know, I had a really hard time finding deals. And I think multifamily has become largely overheated right now. And so we've expanded. My company, Wellings Capital, has expanded our reach outside of multifamily. We love multifamily, always will. But we're also looking at self-storage and mobile home parks right now. Our goal is to get recession-resistant assets from mom-and-pop owners managed passively, or at least from our point of view, passively through great best-in-class operators. And we're working hard on that right now. So that's what we've been up to at Wellings Capital lately.
Great.
Perfect. Thanks for that. So you mentioned your book called The Perfect Investment, and I have read that book. It's actually one of the very first two or three books I read when I was getting into multifamily. So thank you for that. So can you tell us why you feel that multifamily is the perfect investment?
Yeah, you know, the risk adjusted returns of multifamily shine brightly in commercial real estate, and commercial real estate itself has the best risk adjusted returns of any asset class. There was a study done, and I'm actually looking at the graph right now, and it's basically showing commercial real estate far exceeding the risk-adjusted return of small cap, large cap stocks, corporate bonds, government bonds, way, way higher than commodities. And basically, it's the risk and return is phenomenal for commercial real estate. Now, dialing in a little bit further, there's something called the Sharpe ratio, which is S-H-A-R-P-E. And it basically measures the returns divided by the standard deviation or the risk or the volatility of all these asset classes, and multifamily crushes the other commercial real estate classes, and it even more so crushes the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, even private equity stocks multiple times over. Now, I will say they didn't measure self-storage and mobile home parks in this particular graph, which I think they would be up there with, right, you know, with or maybe even better than multifamily. But I think multifamily, you know, again, it people always need a place to live. That's kind of obvious. It's evergreen. It's not dependent on technology. Warren Buffett said, I'd rather invest in chewing gum than the internet, because the internet will never change the way people chew gum. And so it's not invested, you know, it's not based on the latest technology breakthrough or the latest development. It's evergreen. In 1995, the government took some actions that said, basically, if you can fog a mirror, you deserve to own a home. And so what they did is they forced mortgage companies and banks to lend to almost everybody with no-doc loans and all types of different loans. And of course, the banks were happy to comply for about a decade. But then in 2005, after what happened is homeownership skyrocketed from its historical norm of 63 to 64% up to 69.2%. But what happened in 2005 is there were cracks in the ice and people started losing their homes. Foreclosure rates skyrocketed. And of course, we know that the Great Recession followed that. Homeownership plummeted back to its historical norm of 63%. Now, every percentage drop was a million new renters into the renter pool. What happened is American homeowners, Americans have been told for decades that their home was their greatest investment, that it was the cornerstone of the American dream. And people realized, wait a minute, maybe it's not the greatest investment, you know, after they lost their homes, or a lot of folks saw their, you know, friends or parents lose their homes. And so what happened is there were four groups of people who began to be more renting, or, you know, going more toward renting than owning. First, you've got baby boomers. Now, they're the smallest renting class, but they're the fastest growing. And statistics say when a baby boomer, which is generally people 55 years old and above, starts renting, they will never own again on average. Millennials are another group. Millennials are saddled on average with higher debt and a lower desire to own a home than most people historically. A lot of millennials think, you know, why should I tie myself down to a 30-year contract on a seemingly overpriced home when I might get new opportunities, new adventures, new friends across town or across the country or the world next year. So millennials generally aren't as big on home ownership as their predecessors. A third group is immigrants. Immigrants on the average rent more often and for longer than folks who had their who were born in America. And then a fourth group that I didn't cover in my book is Gen Z. Is that right? Gen Z, the new generation? Yeah, and they buy, they're up and coming right now, and they were barely to the renting age when I wrote the book 3 years ago, but now they're renting far more often than buying. So there is an opportunity with multifamily to look decades into the future and go, you know, I think I can see the future, the trends here. We got 77 to 80 million baby boomers, millennials, and Gen Z. All three of those classes have that about that number of folks. And they're going more and more toward renting. I mean, the question is, will we become a renter nation? Dallas is already over 50% rental compared to an older city like Detroit, which is 70% home ownership. You know, Germany is like 57, 58% rentals. Will we go in that direction? I don't know, but I think we could.
Perfect. And so you mentioned earlier that you think multifamily could be overheated, but let's focus on why it's not overheated first. Can you talk about a couple of those reasons?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can look at the interest rate drops. You know, there's a lot of folks talking about zero or negative interest rates now. And, you know, a cap rate, a historic norm cap rate. Okay, so kind of backing up real quick for listeners, cap rate is one of the two defining metrics in determining the value of an asset. And cap rates historically, I mean, even if you read books that weren't written that long ago in training courses, they would talk about an 8, 9, or 10% cap rate as being the norm. That's the expected rate of return for this asset, this location at this point in time. Well, cap rates now are like half that, meaning prices are double that for the same net operating income. And so cap rates now running 5-6% in some areas. I imagine where you are in Southern California, that would be a deal of a lifetime. Maybe your cap rates are running 3.5-4.5%. Well, it's possible that those would actually be good deals if interest rates go negative and people are actually paying to keep their money in a savings account. Well, if that point comes in the future, or if they're paying to own a treasury bill, and again, I don't know if that'll happen, but maybe a 3.5% cap rate will look good by comparison. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all my warnings on bigger pockets the last year or two are going to be wrong. Maybe multifamily is still a good deal. We know the demographics still look phenomenal. The question is, is the pricing too high? I don't know.
Yep. Okay. And now let's go into some reasons about why multifamily is overheated.
Well, so I've identified about 7 reasons in some of my Bigger Pockets articles. I'll see if I can remember them all. A bunch of them start with an I. So one is international money. International money is coming to the U.S. at unprecedented rates. I talked to a large Chinese investor who said, I would be happy with a 0% return if I could just get my money out of the Chinese RMB into U.S. dollars. I said, what? Wait a minute. A 0% return? He said, yeah, because I'm losing. He's projecting 20 to 40% on his currency alone, just staying in Chinese currency. So he wants to get into U.S. Commercial real estate. How can we compete against somebody who's willing to live with a 0% mm-hmm. return? That's tough. Number two, you've got institutional investors. You've got REITs, life insurance companies, large private equity groups who used to want only stabilized assets in gateway cities. And then they move from gateway cities like LA, Chicago, New York, Boston, down to primary cities like Dallas, Atlanta, Houston. And then they move to secondary cities like Charlotte and Cincinnati and Columbus. And now they're moving from the coastal areas all the way into the middle of the U.S. to places like Omaha and Kansas City, and they're dealing with smaller assets and older assets and less stabilized assets. It's hard to compete against an institutional investor. Another group is 1031 money. There's a lot of 1031 exchange money who willingly and knowingly overpays for assets just to avoid paying Uncle Sam. And I'm in a deal right now where somebody's doing that. A fourth group would be IRA investors. There's self-directed IRA investors coming in record numbers. And for some reason, IRA investors are slightly less critical of what they invest in. They're slightly more willing to overpay. And I don't think that's a huge factor, but it is a factor. You've also got NURUs. Now, NURUs might not be a word you're familiar with, but I consider that new gurus. That's people who weren't even investing in real estate in the last crash 11 years ago, but now they're teaching other people how to invest. Some of these NURUs, unfortunately, could be wolves in syndicators' clothing. And what I mean is folks who make money, whether the investor makes money or loses it all. They make money from fees, brokerage commission, admin fees, asset management fees, all kinds of things like that. And I was at a conference about 9 months ago, and one of the largest multifamily investors in the world took the stage, not on the schedule, quite unexpectedly. I was delighted. And he said, hey, it's okay. People talk about worrying about overpaying for multifamily. Don't worry about overpaying. Just get in. Get in. It's a great place to be. And I thought he was joking. I literally thought he was kidding, but there was no punchline. He was serious. And I'll tell you, what he said flies directly in the face of historically wonderful investors like Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, Ray Dalio, Howard Marks. They would all say that's ridiculous. My money's on them.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. That's amazing. So do you think that those reasons alone are enough for an investor to say, okay, let me sit on the sideline, let me not invest in multifamily, and let me wait for the crash to happen and the re-correction?
No, I don't, because there are still mom and pop owners who have not milked the value out of multifamily. There are 1970s, 1980s assets that are severely in need of upgrades and value adds. And upgrades, value adds, poor management, overpaying, they're having a way heavier operating expense burden. All those things are opportunities. Warren Buffett would call it a margin of safety. If somebody can acquire assets like that in this market, I think that even if they had to pay too much, it's okay, because they can quickly and measurably and predictably improve the asset, improve the net operating income, and then create a great investment opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we focus on value add, right? But the piece I think you mentioned there is you need to be able to understand how to manage that asset once you purchase it and actually add that value and control the expenses and things like that. And I think there's a lot of people out there where they're missing that piece. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So I know you shifted your focus from multifamily to other asset classes. So you mentioned them earlier, but what are your top two or three asset classes out there for you right now?
Yeah. So we are still investing in multifamily, but we've also branched out. We're looking for recession resistant assets that we can acquire from mom and pops. And that would be right now, mobile home parks and self storage. Mobile home parks, there are 44,000 in the US, about 39,000, it's estimated, are run and owned by mom and pops. And therefore, they do not know how, or they don't care, or they don't have the resources to get all the value out of that. It's the only asset class that we know of that has a shrinking supply every year, but an increasing demand. The affordable housing crisis is real, and the number of people moving into mobile home parks is significant. You know, 10,000 people a day turn 65, yet 6 out of 10 have $10,000 or less saved for retirement. Well, sometimes their only asset they have is equity in their home, and they're sometimes willing to trade that for a $280 average, national average lot rent at a mobile home park and give them the freedom to retire, have a nicer car, travel, etc. And so we've seen that in mobile home parks. It's a beautiful thing. Self-storage is sort of similar. They also have sticky tenants. Mobile homes, by the way, if you raise their rent up to the market level, I'm not saying gouge people, but if you raise it like say $30 to get it to the market level, which it usually is below market with mom and pop owners, they usually don't spend $5,000 to move their mobile home down the street to avoid a $30 rent increase. Same with self-storage. If I raise rent on an apartment, if I'm renting an apartment to you for $1,000 and I raise it 6%, you're locking in a $720 increase next year. You might move to avoid that. But if I raise your self-storage unit at $100 by 6%, you're probably not going to take a Saturday, get your friends, rent a U-Haul to move your treasures down the street to save $6 a month, especially when you know that you only have a month-to-month lease and you're probably going to be out of there in your mind within 2 or 3 months anyway. So self-storage is very sticky. In bad times, people, you know, are downsizing and they need a place to store their stuff. In good times, people are filling up their Amazon and Walmart carts and they need a place to store their stuff. And there's also a lot of baby boomers passing away right now and their kids need a place to store their stuff. So it really is recession resistant. Self-storage, there are 53,000 facilities in the US and well over 30,000 are owned by independent operators. Most of those are mom and pops who don't know or care to get the value out of those. Some of those can be acquired and dramatically ramped up to get more value and provide more return for the investors. Mm-hmm.
So you have a podcast called How to Lose Money. And tell us what the focus is other than losing money and why you started that podcast.
Yeah, you know, Kyle, years ago, I got to know some people both in my personal life and in my investing career who were fairly well known. And when they would go on stage, they would talk about all their successes. And I would see the people around me kind of shrink down and go, you know, I could never be like him or her. I could never be that successful. I feel like a loser. But I knew some of them and I knew they had terrible personal struggles along the way and sometimes even currently. And so I realized, wow, if they would just be honest and talk about their pain, their struggles, their loss, then people would be encouraged because everybody knows about their own pain, but they don't know about others. So I realized if we started a podcast where we focused on drawing out people's pain and failure and losses along the way, that people be encouraged and they would also realize, there's something I don't want to repeat. So that's what we do. We talk to successful investors, entrepreneurs, managers, business owners about the pain and failure they had along their road to success. We've really enjoyed that. We recently interviewed Keith Elias, who's an NFL football player for 6 years, and now he works for the NFL, and he's got a window into literally thousands of players and their successes and their failures along the way. And he was really helpful. We also have Mike Michalowicz, who wrote Clockwork and Profit First. And we've really enjoyed these 200 or so interviews we've done in the last 3 years.
That's awesome. I love that concept. So is there anything else that you can maybe tell our listeners that could add value to their lives or their investing?
Yeah, you know, I would really say this. If you are working a full-time job, and especially if you have good income, I think you might not like to hear what I'm going to say, but I would say this. I was talking to a lady who was trying desperately to figure out how to invest in a different location geographically. She couldn't afford to invest where she was. And she said, she was just kind of pulling her hair out. How am I going to get a property manager? How am I going to find a realtor I trust? How am I going to make sure I don't overpay? How am I going to find tenants? And then I talked to her about passive investing in commercial real estate. And all of a sudden the light bulb went on for her. And she said, wait a minute, why am I working harder than I need to make less than I could? She had a moment where she realized she should be passively investing. I was talking to an oral surgeon in the Pacific Northwest, and he said, I'm building a portfolio of 20 homes on the side. My wife's an orthodontist, and we're going crazy. I'm on the phone with painters and tenants and all this between surgeries, and I'm only on house number 3. I'm already going nuts. I don't think I can build a portfolio of 20 homes. And I asked him the same question. Why are you working so hard to make less than you could by investing passively? So I think my number one advice would be find a great syndicator, a great operator, and invest passively. Trust them to do the hard work. You get a K-1, which means you get all the tax benefits of direct ownership in real estate, but you don't have to do all the hard work. Yeah, I realize you don't get the thrill of the chase. And if you really want that, there's other ways to get that. You can actually be a deal finder or a money finder or all kinds of things for a syndicator. But I would say if you're doing this, if you have a full-time well-paying job, or if you're enjoying retirement, I would not launch into this. You're swimming with sharks, especially at this point in the cycle. I would highly recommend that you invest passively.
Yep, great advice. Thanks for that. All right, Lalita is going to take us into our final 4 questions. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
As an apartment investor, you need a website to look professional. Typically, the process of building a professional website can be a real pain, taking thousands of dollars and months of your time. Apartment Investor Pro makes it quick and painless. In fact, you can have your website up and running as soon as today. Go to apartmentinvestorpro.com and use coupon code LIMITLESS to save 10% on your website.
All right, Paul, what is the one tool you use in real estate investing that you cannot do without?
So for me, you know, I'm taking my own advice, investing passively myself. And we at Wellings Capital have put together a team of folks who do a lot of work to vet great operators and provide those investment opportunities to our investors. So the tool that I use probably more than any other than email, I guess, is HubSpot. I really enjoy HubSpot. There's actually a free version. It's one of the most powerful database management tools on the planet. And it's actually very, very expensive, but there's a free version. And for over 3 years, we've enjoyed using that, and we have not needed to spend the, I think, $10,000 a year to upgrade.
Yeah, that's great. I think Kyle uses that a lot. So that's a really good tool.
Yep.
Can you tell us a story about your biggest mistake in real estate investing and the main takeaway for our listeners?
How many hours do you have again? No, seriously. I can really try to tell you this quickly. So in going into 2000, in 1997, I had about $2 million in the bank. And a decade later, in the fall of 07, exactly a decade later, I had $2.5 million in debt. And that was against a whole lot of speculative real estate properties. You know, investing is when your principal is generally safe and you can make a return, but speculating is when your principal is not at all safe and you have a chance to make a return. And I was a speculator, even though I thought I was an investor. And so I had all this speculative real estate. And so we went into 2008. Now remember, 11 years ago, going into 2008, we had no idea of what we were facing. We thought maybe the rumblings of 06 to 07 were the end of it, and we were already through the worst of the so-called recession. Well, we weren't, we didn't know we were about to plunge into the deepest recession since the Depression. But anyway, my partner quit and he signed the deeds over to me, which means I had all of that debt, not just half of it. And I was, my back was against the wall. And I had a couple friends who recommended I declare bankruptcy. And I said, no, I got an idea. I was meditating one morning and I actually asked myself, what would George Mueller do? Now, he's one of my historical heroes. George Mueller was actually a guy who had orphanages in England. And he would, he basically did all kinds of radical things and he always seemed to succeed. So I said, we're going to give our way out of debt. And of course, I got crickets from my friends on that one, because they said, what are you talking about? I said, we're going to start giving aggressively to nonprofits, charities, church, things we're passionate about, and we're going to see what happens. Well, 4 weeks later, in the end of January 2008, I had a light bulb idea that led to me doing some really creative real estate moves throughout 2008. And within 13 months, I was completely debt free. Now, I use the story because it was my biggest failure. The details of it are not important, but basically the speculating in real estate is the point of that. But it was also turned out to be my biggest success because I ended up debt-free 13 months later.
Yeah, wow. All right, what is it that you need to do now to grow your life to the next level?
You know, I've struggled for decades with time management, and I have read The One Thing by Gary Keller and Jay Papasan, and I'm trying to apply that to my life continually, scheduling my days, prioritizing, but I still need help in that area. I'm still working hard on learning to manage my time.
I think we all are. And finally, where can people find out more about you, Paul?
They can visit us at our website. It's wellingscapital.com. That's WellingsCapital, wellingscapital.com. They can email us info@wellingscapital.com.
Perfect. Well, needless to say, you set quite the benchmark. Congrats on all that you've done. And listeners, please make sure that you check out Paul's book and podcast.
Thanks, Lolita. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate podcast and to get access to today's show notes and to previous shows, visit limitless-estates.com. If you enjoyed this show, please subscribe to the podcast. Thanks again for joining us. Be sure to tune in again next week for another episode.